Vinny, welcome to the show. How are things in New Zealand?
They're nice. They're starting to get a little warmer, finally. It's been a freezing, ridiculous, and kind of crazy year. Well, 2014 was, but now, according to the Chinese zodiac, 2015 is the year of the sheep. So for all us conspiracy theorists out there, it's probably going to be an even worse year than last year.
Wait, is 2016 the year of the shepherd then, or what?
I don't know. I thought 2016 was like the year of the barbecue, or the year of the FEMA camp. I forget. I'm not overly familiar with the Chinese zodiac. Maybe it might be the year of the Falun Gong organ harvesting.
I didn't know the Chinese zodiac system, the constellations. They have a FEMA camp up there or something. I'm not sure.
They have some kind of like, I don't know, forced work labor camp next to a hospital or something. You know, just in case you need a spare organ lying around or whatever. Hey, are you a Falun Gong practitioner? Yeah. Are you nonviolent? Yeah. Okay. Good. We kill you. We're not without resistance. and sell your organ on black market. Yeah. I just came off a Facebook conversation with a friend of mine about, statists slaughtering millions of people, you know, like kind of communist regimes killing about 100 million people last century, more than any other unnatural cause of death. And he's trying to make the point that they were trying to throw off the bankers and things like that. And I go, okay, so sacrificing 100 million people to throw off the bankers... and not getting anywhere. I don't understand the mentality, because for me it's not about communism or capitalism anymore. It's about authoritarianism, ultimately. Yeah. If somebody thinks they've got authority over my life, I don't like them. They may or may not have authority over my life, because they can basically kill you or take your life apart, really, at any point. We're basically just sitting ducks here, unless you have the military force to repel the government. Mm-hmm. You're kind of at their mercy. And Mao was right. Political power does come from the barrel of the gun. That's why the government banned us all having guns.
Yeah. Put two and two together, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's that? Is that called, what, democide or something like that? Isn't that what that's called, where it's like governments actually kill more people than plagues and, you know, starvation and all that stuff? I think that's the term.
It's the leading cause of death up until recently, where the American Medical Association took that title. At least in America, anyway.
Yeah. I'm guessing most people know who you are and stuff like that, but do you want to give yourself a little introduction to, like, your show and all that?
Yeah, I probably should, actually. I'm Vinny Eastwood. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And I'm in my fifth year of talk radio. I'm the first New Zealander to be given an American talk radio platform, like, ever. I have been making YouTube videos a number of years before going into talk radio, and currently have New Zealand's most subscribed YouTube news channel, more than the New Zealand Herald TV, which is our equivalent of the New York Times. And I have done this by myself because I had a moral obligation to. When I was 19, like a lot of university students, I was selling weed, and one person who I sold to narked on me. So there were half a dozen police and a dog that came into my house, and I gave them everything I had. I was like, oh, okay, I'm being busted. All right, here's my baggies, here's my weed, here's my stash, here's my tin, here's my pipe, here's my all of that kind of stuff, so that they wouldn't actually have to search the house at all. You know, I just made their job easy for them, signed a full confession, said that, yes, I'm a drug dealer, I've been dealing for 8 months, and that kind of thing. Totally naive. And so naturally they charged me with selling $40,000 of weed, because I said that I'd been dealing over 8 months, about an ounce a week. You know, just basic blatant fabrication. Like, there's no way there's that much money going through your hands. And not for a university student who's paying $60 a week rent, you know. I mean, come on. I'm not living the life of right. But what was interesting to me was that even though they had a full confession and all the evidence that they needed, they still made up evidence.
Like what? What did they do?
Well, like that $40,000 projection, for example. Mm-hmm. And these charges were dropped because they didn't advise me of my right to remain silent beforehand, conveniently enough. And when I went into for sentencing, they told me I was up for maybe 8 years in prison. For a first offence, for possession of 13 grams of cannabis ready for sale.
Jesus.
So when you're 19 and you hear that, kind of changes your perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it gets treated as seriously as manslaughter. Like, I could have accidentally killed someone and gotten less grief from the justice system than having 13 grams of cannabis for sale. You know. And I just had this vision this morning of a police officer telling somebody to drop a bottle of water, you know, put it down on the ground. I'm afraid that you might accidentally kill yourself with 300 mils of water. Because water's killed more people than cannabis, hasn't it?
In fact, I don't think anyone's died from cannabis, right? As far as I know.
I mean, everything that has ever caused death in any way, shape, or form, from peanut allergies to choking on a pubic hair, has killed more people than cannabis. All right? It's completely insane. And the guy in front of me in sentencing was there for sexual assault and resisting arrest and growing 5 cannabis plants. And it wasn't his first offense. He got 150 hours community service. I was there for my first offense, 13 grams of cannabis. I got 300 hours community service. I was very lucky I didn't go to jail for up to 8 years as well. And that was because the police didn't push for a custodial sentence. And I'm very lucky, but unfortunately it was an indictable charge. And drug dealing is a very, very serious thing. And a lot of people hook up their friends and things like that. But the thing is, if you get busted at any point, you're screwed. Like, I lost all my people I thought were my friends. All these people coming around to buy weed and smoking it with me. Or never saw any of them again. Ever.
They just turned your back?
All of them.
Wow.
My girlfriend was over in Japan, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to travel again, so I had to write an email to her and tell her what happened and how we can't really be together because I'd never be able to go see her home country because Japan doesn't allow people with cannabis convictions in, especially not for dealing.
Mm-hmm. So are you sort of like imprisoned in New Zealand now because of this?
No. I mean, I haven't traveled out of New Zealand since this happened. This happened like 10 years ago. And unlike a lot of people, I can reach out to other countries, right? Mm-hmm. So most New Zealanders who have this kind of legal condition predicament that I do, they can't travel and they don't really know people in other countries. Whereas me, through the internet, through my videos and radio show, the bulk of my audience are not New Zealanders, mm-hmm. by a pretty wide margin, mostly American. And I had a realization the other day that, throughout my entire life, I've been getting perpetually taken under the wing of people. Like, people stick up for me when they don't have to. That kind of thing. It's sort of like being the youngest child. How you don't really get all the attention, but you kind of get a little bit of extra special help from people because they understand. I don't know what it is, but I'm quite grateful anyway. I became a salesman after going back to university, and I quit uni while I was doing telemarketing because I was making a lot of money doing telemarketing. I was the top salesperson in the whole company for like 6 months solid. Like, every single day I pulled more sales than any other single person. and I was writing an essay at university about anti-television discourse, right? Basically talking smack about TV. This is one of the essay topics you're supposed to give, and they gave you all these required readings of all this. All these people had written all these books over time about how bad TV was for everybody. Now, my assumptions were that TV is kind of bad in a lot of ways for people. Reduced attention span, it gives people something in common to talk about, but that thing that they have in common is a fictional context. And one of my arguments was that people wouldn't be able to relate to each other for anything real. And I showed this essay to one of my mates' dad, who's an English professor there at Auckland University, and he said one of the best essays he's read. And I was inclined to agree, because it was the very first time I'd ever actually applied myself to a topic. Like, suddenly I was really passionate about this, and for the first time ever, I was reading source materials, doing a full-on bibliography and reference notes and quoting passages and things like that, because all my assumptions about television going in, I found out were exactly, almost word for word, what other people had said in the past during the birth of television about the drawbacks and the possible bad things that can come from it. And in my opinion, most of the bad things that have been prophesied about television's effect on society have kind of come to pass. And they gave me a D for writing that essay, a D minus. So I was like, that was just a wake-up call to me. Suddenly I realized that higher education wasn't actually going to make me any smarter, wasn't actually really going to give me any extra skills, wasn't really of value to me at all as a creative person who can think. Because university doesn't teach people to think critically as they say that they do. They merely teach them to be critical of those who can still think despite being university educated. And my gut feeling was, this place is just wrong. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was in college, for like a year and a half or something like that. And I ended up, I think it was like some sort of like Western civilization class or something like that. But we had to do this essay, and I did this like 26-page poem, and it was on It was on the Vikings, and I ended up swearing in it because I was like playing the part of a Viking, right? You know, that makes sense. I mean, Vikings are kind of like harsh, crass, you know, crude people. And I ended up getting a D on it because she says it was unprofessional that I swore. And at that point, after I quit school, I was like, if I ever have to give another professional speech again, I'm cursing. The first thing I'm going to do is curse. It was like, because that, it wasn't because it wasn't, you know, the information wasn't good, or the, you know, the poem wasn't good and that sort of thing. It was because I cursed, because I wasn't following the mold. I wasn't following a line. So I totally see what you're saying.
Yeah. Never underestimate the power of stupid rules and being forced to follow them. And in my opinion, that's basically just a form of mind control. Bureaucratic mindset. I went into a movie theater the other day, bro, and I had bare feet.
So you had what?
I had bare feet, you know.
Oh, okay.
On my shoes. So dude comes up to me and he says, hey, you can't go in there and watch a movie that you just paid like $15 for because you don't have any shoes. And I go, really? And they say, yes, it's a health and safety standard. And I go, okay, well, hold on a second. What's going to happen if I go in there with no shoes? Well, I mean, Is the floor blessed and you think that I'm a servant of Satan or something? You think my feet are going to catch on fire, you know, burn the whole place down? And no, it's just if there's a fire and you're not wearing shoes, you might trip up. Well, hold on a second, bro. I don't have shoelaces on. I'm even less likely to trip off than... You know? It's just
stupid. You had sandals on. Like
I had to run across the parking complex to a shoe shop and walked right in, saw a pair of flip-flops, grabbed them. I was out in two shakes, and I just carried them back. I didn't even walk in them, bro, because I just don't like wearing shoes anymore, you know? It's they're just sweaty and hot and freaking disgusting, and when you take them off, your feet reek in a bad sexual way. And I have this kind of aversion to following rules just in general if they don't make sense. Mm-hmm. Right? If a rule makes sense, I will follow it, and I will encourage other people to follow it. If it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, it's kind of your duty to disobey it. At the very least, question it.
Is that been something that's been part of like your genetic makeup? Have you, I mean, is that, have you always been kind of the rebellious type since you were young, or?
Well, I'm not sure if it comes from my bloodlines or something, because some of my ancestors, there was a uncle and auntie, or a brother and sister, and she sang and he played the piano, and they toured the finest entertainment houses of London. Great-grandfather, I think, was an incredible sculptor, and there's a sort of a mural running around the Auckland Museum here with all these depictions of war and what have you, and he was the carver that did the faces on all of the characters on that wall. My father started up a electrician company, in the late 60s. He was the first company to employ radio technology to put radios in the vans and connect them to home base, so they actually didn't have to return to home base to get their next job. They could just stay on the road and get out there. He then branched out into forklift tires. He invented the mechanism that could bond steel to rubber. He solved the traction problems and the freezing works that they were having with the wheels spinning and what have you. And I think by the early 90s, late 80s, he had a 97% market share for the sale of all forklift tires in the Southern Hemisphere, and personally designed over 400 different types of forklift tires.
Well,
so you kind of sit there and you're like, okay, this is what I come from. You kind of have an obligation, right? Mm-hmm. If you're special, you know, and I'm not being egotistical about it, okay? No more than Muhammad Ali was being egotistical when he said, I'm going to dance around you and I'm going to knock you out. All right? He's just telling you what's going to happen. And I've got great talent, big heart, incredible creativity, and a good sense of humor. And it's exactly what the Truth Movement needs right now. Ultimately, if you look at the Truth Movement, you look at the vast spectrum of the topics that kind of need to be covered, everything from A to Z, you know, aliens to zoanthropes, and the other element here is just to be able to deal and process A, that amount of information, and B, the darkness of it, right? Because you're going to be learning things that are really upsetting. And I've come up with a philosophical tool. It's called Occam's Razor, which is, if there are two options, the option that sounds the most horrible, that you don't want to be true, is probably the correct one.
It's the new science.
No, I mean, this is how you've got to look at the world if you want to be realistic about it, you know?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of truth to that, you know?
That's the problem with being jaded and cynical, is you become correct a lot of the time. And it's almost like you wish to be wrong, but it's the same as sort of like wishing for a pony on Christmas. It just doesn't happen, bro.
Have you gotten jaded for, you know, 5 years of doing this? I guess more than that, but doing the radio show. Have you gotten a little bitter, jaded at, you know, all of the lies and the corruption and all of that stuff?
Well, it's about pattern recognition. So somebody will come up to me and say that they're involved with child, youth and family services or something of that nature, the New Zealand equivalent of CPS in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So pattern recognition comes up, sort of like, you know, on the Terminator, he's got these little readouts that come up. So somebody can say a word or a topic or start me telling me their story, and all of this background chatter information starts coming up for me. So if somebody's talking about children and the state, First things that come to mind are pedophile ring, corrupt courts, and it kind of all flows on from there, because after you've realized that there is a global pedophile ring that's using the governments and their child protective services arms to extract children from good parents so that they can hire them out to local pedophiles like doctors, lawyers, judges, etc., psychopathic pedophile freaks with a lot of power and a lot of connections and a lot of money. This time when people come up to me and they assume that I don't know their story. And what's funny is I can tell them the elements of their story exactly as they told it to me because I've heard it so many times over and over. And that's when you get jaded and cynical, is when you stop finding out things that are new, once you've actually kind of come to the end of the rabbit hole and you've actually seen the darkness for what it is, and you understand the depth of it, you understand how bad it is, and then the next step is learning how to emotionally deal with it. Now, me, I need to take long periods of time off, because when you're, I don't do interviews like, oh, I've done a prep and I've got a team and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. When I'm talking on radio, when I'm interviewing somebody, when they're telling me their pain and their trauma, I'm really there. I'm really in the moment. I'm actually really listening to them. I'm trying to feel what they feel so that I can understand what they know. And as a result, you take on certain emotional damage from each of the people that you interview, depending on the topic. The damage level varies. But when you notice that you're starting to hate inexplicably, like I'll just sit there hating nothing at all. I don't know whether I hate myself, whether I hate the people for not waking up, whether I hate the New World Order for forcing us asleep in the first place, or whether or not I actually really hate this person that I'm arguing with so virulently on Facebook. You kind of get to that point where you realize that you're not hateful. You're not, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just burnt out. You've taken on too much baggage. And, you know, it's like overburdening a donkey with baggage.
It's the appropriate response, right?
You just have to dump it. Like, I cancelled, like, as many as four different shows and appearances in December because I literally couldn't, I knew that I couldn't actually make it almost even past November because I was that close to, like, having a full-on mental breakdown. And I think maybe this is the reason why a lot of people become so jaded and so cynical that they refuse to feel, they refuse to empathize, and eventually they refuse to listen, is because they know that this is the natural consequence of it. I, on the other hand, have a different approach. While, yes, I understand that this is the consequence of my work, what I also understand is the unforeseen consequences to the guest, because you'll be maybe nearly all of my guests have told me at some point that I'm one of the best interviewers they've ever been with, and it's because of that openness, because of that honesty, it's because they don't feel the need to defend themselves, to qualify statements and things like that. I'm here just to let you speak your piece, you know, go for your life, son. Imagine you're talking to somebody who won't judge you, won't attack you, won't second guess you, won't make you feel uncomfortable. Imagine that it's your show, and I'm simply the douchebag with the microphone here to insert little jokes and you know, nice little philosophies here or there to make it all warm and fuzzy while you tell them about the horrible things that happened to you.
Mm-hmm. That's I would completely agree with that, because that's actually one of the things that, you know, I think listening to you is that, you know, I mean, since starting this show, I have a newfound respect for good interviewers, because it's hard to keep a conversation going, things like that. But if I would have tried this like maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, I think I would have failed, because I don't I hadn't learned enough. I hadn't grown enough. I hadn't illuminated myself enough to tackle some of the subjects that some of these guests bring to the show. So I can only imagine what it's like on your end to actually be that open, that receiving, to get into the heart of what somebody's, you know, speaking about. So I agree. Yeah. It's,
well, the whole movement, the philosophy and the research, it's all actually done by people, isn't it? And it's kind of like I've shifted my priorities around a little bit. So I used to prioritize listening to talk radio, watching documentaries and YouTube videos, and now I focus on making talk radio and making documentaries and videos. And as a result, I don't really have time to do those things that I used to do. And you kind of become almost sheltered and closed off from the world, almost isolated, which is ironic because the entire time when I'm at home here on my computer, I'm communicating with like hundreds of people every single day across Facebook and Skype and email alone. And it's really quite an odd sensation to think that your life objective is to help people deal with life itself when you're not really there for them. You know, you're not there to give them a hug. You're not there to tell them it's going to be okay in their darkest hour. But I've recorded these things. There's been some freaking wicked shows that I've listened back to, and I was like, man, am I saying that? That's freaking awesome. You know, like I'll listen to myself and then get inspired by myself, you know. Yeah. And we've had people message in and tell us that basically before they heard the Vinnie Eastwood show, they were going to commit suicide. They were planning on it.
Jesus.
But they learned to laugh about all the terrible things around them, realized that things weren't that bad, and decided to live.
So when you get into, when you get overwhelmed, you go into those dark places, you get a little depressed, you get a little jaded, whatever, how do you get out of it? Besides just taking time off, how do you keep the sense of humor?
I was interviewing a comedian one time, a New Zealand comedian called Wyeth Chalmers. And I asked him, what's the essence of a good joke? How do you make jokes out of things? And he goes, well, jokes are basically based on anything around you. You know, if somebody's wearing a funny hat or something puzzles you, or you think it's kind of ironic or kind of strange right there in front of you, there's the makings for a good joke. And I said to him, is it because comedians are so bright that they realize the truth behind things around them, and it pisses them off so completely that they are forced to make a joke about it in order to survive? And he said, yeah, that's pretty much spot on. All right, so you know, my philosophy is just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed?
out of all the guests that you've had on, has there been like one guest, or is there any like one particular topic that's really totally floored you? I mean, is there one that you can kind of point out in these last 5 years?
Well, ultimately it happens all the time. But some of the ones that stick out for me are just kind of like those big names that you see, interviewed on other people's shows. And you get to see a different side of them on my show. Because it's not like you're trying to preach to the unconverted sort of thing. You know, when you're in certain social situations and you know that everybody's on the same level, for example, take cannabis, right? If you go into a party and everybody's smoking cannabis, do you feel apprehensive about pulling out your weed tin and having a cone? No, you don't. Because you know it's basically accepted. So you feel comfortable and you're ready to open up. But the truth movement is very similar to that, whereby before you talk to people, you need to know that they will understand what you're talking about before you say it. Because it makes you very paranoid, because you might get called a conspiracy theorist at any point. Mm-hmm. And so conspiracy theorists, and I say this in a positive way, by the way, avoid using the term conspiracy because it makes people see them as conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
And here's the defining term for it. Reality is somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. But on one side of the spectrum, there's coincidence theorists. Everything happens by coincidence. Mm-hmm. All power plays, everything is done with the pure altruistic intentions and sound economic reasoning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, there is conspiracy theory par excellence, which sees a pattern in absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, somewhere, there are some coincidences and there are some patterns to some things, and that's kind of where I like to sit. But ultimately, you got to really just keep a sense of humor about you. It's the one thing that'll keep you alive and keep you sane. Gives that nice release of endorphins. It's good for your heart and lungs and everything. So get some friends that make you laugh, man. I mean, I just noticed yesterday, that's basically what I do. I just try to make people laugh all the time, just as a matter of course. And I don't know exactly what the end effect of that is. I wanted to get into stand-up comedy, you know, because I was really inspired by Bill Hicks and George Carlin and the greats, you know. Mm-hmm. And questioning society and making fun of its inadequacies was something that George Carlin and Bill Hicks made into an art form. And I've sort of defined my show as what would happen if a therapist watched too much Bill Hicks and George Carlin and listened to too much Alex Jones. Kind of like that. Really into conspiracy, really into comedy, but also really into giving a frack about people, ultimately, at the end of the day. That's really what's missing, having a laugh and having a hug.
Yeah, the comedy sort of makes, it's almost like the sugar in the pill or something. It makes it go down easier, right?
Yeah. I mean, if I were to tell you something really terrible and horrible and just leave you with that, how do you wind up feeling about it? Pretty terrible and horrible. If I tell you something that's terrible and horrible and then tell you a joke about it and then tell you what you can actually do in your own life about it, you leave differently. And this whole element of, oh, tell us the solutions, don't tell us the problem. I want to ignore the problem, just tell me the solution. And my question is, how exactly are you going to solve a problem that you don't understand? Right? Somebody's just going to give you the solution? Oh, yeah, like somebody else knows all the answers. Actually, the burden's on you, son. You're the one with the answers. You're the one with the ideas. You're the one with the creativity. You're the person who's able to take things out of nothingness and your own head by power of creativity and will it into existence and then actually affect the entirety of the 3D universe by creating something that doesn't yet exist. For documentary ideas in your head and you don't bring it out into reality, how many people around you get affected by it? None. But if you take ownership of your ideas and those little urges that you have inside your head that tell you to do things, then you wind up changing reality itself.
Mm-hmm. How much do you feel like independent media has helped wake people up in general to that moral obligation, the personal responsibility that they have?
I don't know about independent media. I think about individual efforts seem to make the case, and you know, you can throw out names like Alex Jones and David Icke and Mark Passio and Thomas Sheridan and goodness knows how many hundreds and hundreds of others. Like you can think about so many different occult researchers and people in so many fields in the realm of scumbaggery research. And you can look up nearly any name on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, and the chances are they'll probably be there. They've been interviewed, or I've been on their show, or something like this. And I did that for a specific reason. I don't really have, you know, too many guests that are on regularly, like all the time. I always like meeting new people, broaching new topics, and I really wanted the world's largest online archive of conspiracy theorist confessionals. Tell me your sins.
so you were speaking before about the spectrum, about the coincidence, or the, you know, the coincidence theorist, conspiracy theorist, and so, and you've interviewed tons of people. Like you just said, you like to talk to new people all the time. Like, what's been the most out there thing where you're like talking to somebody, you're like, whoa, what are you saying right here?
That would be Donald Marshall, who told me that I was a clone who got his consciousness transported out of his body at night just after I go to sleep, and then into a cloning facility deep underground somewhere where they transplant my consciousness into a clone of me when they do nasty things to it or get me to sing for them or something, and then transplant my consciousness back into my body before I wake up. That was a little bit hard to swallow.
So how did you keep going in the interview? I mean, did you
just kind of, well, you just kind of sit there and hear them out. All right. You ever heard the phrase, give him enough rope to hang himself?
Mm-hmm, sure.
All right. And my other philosophy is that even in a desert of lies, if you look hard enough, you can find a grain of truth. And he talked a lot about the Vril Society and these kind of things. Basically, what he appeared to me to be very unwell. In fact, I don't really want to talk about Donald Marshall because I've got like these messages from him. It's just these long strings of like crazy sort of stuff. It's oof, my God. Basically, he said that he was going to make me rich. And I don't know about you, bro, but the second somebody offers me something big, I'm instantly skeptical.
Oh, of course, right?
Yeah. I've been offered so many like big opportunities. Like, oh, I've got a gold mine. When I sell it, I'm going to give you $3 million. Oh, I've got this house that's for sale. When I sell that, I'm gonna actually donate the proceeds to you or something like that. People offer big stuff all the time. None of them come up with the goods. All right. No. You know, and I've kind of had to learn that. I learned that lesson much earlier on, even before getting into this industry, because I originally wanted to just get into the major movie making industry or whatever, like my cousin's Lucy Lawless, and tried to talk to her about getting into the industry and stuff like that. No help whatsoever. So I figured, okay, if I'm going to get famous, if I'm going to make anything, I have to basically do it myself. And I have. Sometimes the best gift somebody can give you is telling you that you have to help yourself and you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you earn something, it's extremely gratifying because you did it yourself, right?
Well, nobody can take it away from you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, apart from when I made a 6-minute video about the Prime Minister John Key, our former Federal Reserve corporate banker Prime Sinister. My YouTube channel got taken out 2 weeks before leading up to the New Zealand election where he got re-elected.
Yeah, yeah. So what ended up happening with that? I mean, obviously it's back online now.
Well, have you ever seen V for Vendetta?
No, honestly, I've never seen that movie. No.
Okay. The 5th of November is Guy Fawkes Day to commemorate Guy Fawkes, the last man to enter Parliament with honourable intentions. And guess which day my YouTube channel got restored on? So I was like standing on my deck, and I live in West Auckland, okay? West Auckland gets a bit rowdy. And oh my God, dude, everybody in my street must have been saving up their fireworks for a long, long time just to give me that celebratory night, eh? I couldn't afford no fireworks, but they were going on all around me. It was like, boom, boom, and I was sitting there with a beer just going, yes, my channel is back, boom! So 2,955 videos.
And holy, oh wow.
When I discovered that they'd been taken down, I kind of dropped to the floor for a bit and just sort of like lay face down. I was like, okay, let's just deal with this. Let's just process this 7 years of your life gone. Yeah, okay. Okay. There must be some kind of recourse. Aha! Google account. I'm going to email them and tell them that, why did you delete my Mac thingy? And I did email them. And they said, hey, this email is from a banned YouTube account. So sign into your banned YouTube account and send us an email that's banned, and then we'll reply to you.
So what was their reasoning for taking it down then?
Their reasoning was, it could be spam, it could be abuse, it could be misleading, or it could be harmful. So it could be anything.
Shit out of YouTube is.
No, it could be anything. And the reason why they restored it is because they found out that it wasn't any of those things, and then they gave it back to me, and that was it. You know.
How convenient. What timing.
Yeah.
Jesus. If that isn't transparent, I don't know what is. Wow.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? It might have been the fact that I was putting that John Key video up all over the his political party page and things like that, and all the comment and thread sections, and there could have quite conceivably been a rather large flurry of people flagging the video as inappropriate or spam or misleading or something of that nature. And so the YouTube algorithm automatically takes the complainant's word for it and then bans your channel before telling you that there's even a warning about it.
Yeah.
And then they review it. And 2 months later, they go, well, apparently there wasn't anything to those complaints. So here's your channel back. That was basically it. There's no apology, no nothing. But I think now that I got it back, what I did is I monetized all my videos. I was like, okay, it was all Creative Commons. Anybody could download any of my videos for free and use them in their own documentaries. But, you know, nobody was doing that. And the people weren't editing any of the raw footage up and putting it into it. So I was like, bugger it. I'll just monetize the whole lot. And now I'm getting Google AdSense revenue, which can pay me, which pays basically 1 week of rent out of every month. You know,
yeah,
that's not too bad for 2,955 videos made over 7 or 8 years. I guess I think I'm entitled to that. I've got the largest online archive of Kiwi protest that's available online for free anywhere, and all you have to do is like watch an ad that you can skip after 5 seconds. So yeah.
You don't see any like conflict of interest there, because right, I mean it's one thing, it's like, you know, you're protesting something, but then all of a sudden there's an ad for Tide or something like that before, which is like, I'm not interested in selling Tide, but at the same time it's almost like playing the game. Do you see any conflict there personally? Because I don't do ads on my YouTube channel because I just fucking can't. I just can't do it. But at the same time I'm like, if I'm a struggling person and I have a full-time job, if I didn't have that full-time job, chances are I'm going to be putting ads on there, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's kind of like, in fact, I did a Facebook status about this exact topic just a few days ago about people who make money in the truth movement. Now, I think that there's a couple of elements to this that people need to realize. Now, number one, do you live in the system? Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Do you need food, shelter, water? Yes, you do. Does it help if you also, I don't know, have internet, a stable place to live and work with which to spread your information that stops people from getting freaking exterminated without being aware of it? Okay? You know, we've got to kind of get over it here. How much damage do I do by having an ad revenue thingy versus not having it? Okay, and the answer is it doesn't actually make really much of a difference either way, in a very literal sense, does it?
No.
All right, nobody died, nobody's out of pocket or anything like that. Now, so what people are doing is that they're operating basically under a learned assumption. Anyone doing good for the world has to be broke. Yeah. Only the people who destroy it can get rich without being criticized for it. And anyone who does good and helps people while making money off it is obviously evil and working for the dark forces. Does that sound insane?
Yeah, where does that come from? That's the question. Because I get that as well. It's like, oh, you sell, you know, it's like I give most of my shit away, you know, and then I sell a few books and people are like, oh, you're just trying to hamstring people and you're a kook or, you know, it's like you're trying to get rich. It's like, it's not the case whatsoever, but a guy's got to eat, right?
Yeah, it's like, bro, have you written a book?
Yeah, yeah.
have you devoted thousands upon thousands of hours to enlightening the human effing race by producing something good enough for them to consume that will actually generate a little bit of knowledge and wisdom and possibly a better tomorrow through some form of ripple effect? If you are not doing that, if you're sitting in your car in traffic for several hours a day doing nothing on your way to a job which achieves nothing, and you go home and you watch TV and do nothing, you have no right to criticize the people who spend their spare time and their life doing something. And it doesn't matter what your contribution is to the human race. Every war is fought not only by soldiers on the front lines. There are cooks, there are nurses, there are doctors, there are planners, there are people who fill up vehicles and people who fix down broken axles and things of that nature. All of which mean that the people on the front line don't die the first day that they go out so that they can continue to survive. The truth movement, I feel, is a war against scumbaggery, the actives, motants, and portents of scumbags. And so, if we are going to have any form of resistance against it, we need to be resisting it in every conceivable way. All right. How many ways currently is the New World Order screwing your life up? All right. The answer is every single way. Yeah. So how many ways is it possible to resist that agenda? In any way you want. You get an idea in your head. I think I might go out with a megaphone in a suburb and just start talking about police state legislation in order to coax a cop out, so that he'll come and talk to me so I can film he and I having a conversation about a police state and put cops telling people to stop protesting and then put it on online and get 10,000 hits and do it so well and so smoothly and so confidently that people actually start to mimic some of the behaviors that you exuded during that video and prevent themselves getting arrested a number of times when they talk really nicely and peaceably and calmly and rationally to a police officer instead of getting angry with them and calling them a pig. You see? Every time that you make an effort to make the world a better place, the world does get made a better place. It usually just not as much as you want or hope.
Yeah. You were just talking about protesting. You do a lot of protesting in New Zealand. Do you feel like there's a lot of efficacy in protesting? Has it raised a lot of awareness and that sort of thing?
No. Oh my god! Like when you go to a protest, like people say, "Oh, protesting accomplishes nothing. Accomplishes nothing." And it's like, well, that's not entirely true, because when you go to protest, there's two things that happen. Number one, there's a march and chanting, and number two, there is a point where the speakers get up and speak to the crowd, give them information, activists, authors, doctors, lawyers, and educated people who actually know the issue that the protest is actually about, who get an opportunity to stand up for 3 to 5 minutes to elucidate upon their particular awareness of the scumbaggery which everybody's protesting about. Now, that by itself, talking to the converted, there's only, let's say, 800 people at the protest, doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. It's better than doing nothing, of course. Mm-hmm. But if somebody's there with a camera, i.e. me, and I stick the wireless microphone on them, just whoosh, so you've got some good sound. I've got set up another camera on a tripod to their left, and I stand to their right with my GoPro mounted on my shoulder, and I film them with two camera angles with crystal clear sound and then publish that video, and they get about 2,000 to 3,000 hits on YouTube as a result of that. So I've actually increased the amount of people that heard their speech by 300 plus percent. So my job is to give amplification to voices, not necessarily to speak for them. And it's just because activists, they they don't have my skill set, and I don't have theirs. They do things like read boring legislation and pore over books, do reference notes, keep watch on people, file official Information Act requests, and do things in a proper documented way. They go into court. They have the capacity and the skills and the patience and the dignity to do those things that I cannot do. As a result, I feel guilty, and in order to alleviate my guilt, I use these skills that they do not have to film and edit and publish these things that they do, so that others can be aware, so that they do not get forgotten, so that people will know who these people are and the great job and the service that they do for their country, not because they have to, but because they want to. They feel that they have a moral obligation to. Ain't nobody paying them. They're not employees. These are people who stand up for what's right because it is the right thing to do, knowing that it needs no further justification. And I'm deeply honored to serve them.
Where, like, in your opinion, where is New Zealand at in its general consciousness? I mean, are a lot of people awake, or do you see most people still fast asleep?
Well, I saw a picture the other day of a whole bunch of sheep being herded over a gravel road, and so I quickly made a meme out of it. New Zealanders rush to re-elect corporate banker John Key.
Oh, I saw that, yeah. So I guess that answers that question.
Yeah. I do have another meme as well that said that truthers are very, up themselves, and they call people the sheeple or the sheep or something, which I think is inherently disrespectful and completely rude, which is why I prefer to call them slave scum. And I do that because I'm actually a slave. Okay, I know that I'm a slave. It doesn't matter what kind of window dressing you want to put it up. Do you still pay some form of taxation? Yes. Did you volunteer to pay those taxes? No. Do you know where any of those taxes are going? No. You're a slave, bro. Okay? Shut up. You know, stop protesting and thinking that you're protecting your freedoms. You're going to be protesting knowing that your freedoms don't exist anymore, and expect the exact same kind of resistance as you would from a slave master.
Mm-hmm. So what about some solutions? Because, I mean, it's like you say one person can change the world, and that's true in many respects. One person can change a lot. But one person could also be murdered, shut up, sent to prison, stuff like that. It seems like if we really want to start breaking these chains, there has to be some sort of mass movement, because otherwise it's, as you said before, the Mao quote, it's we're at the barrel of the gun. Like, how do we start these mass movements? Do you think that's even possible?
Have you been in the military?
No,
neither have I. So you and I aren't going to be the ones that are teaching people how to stab officers through the Kevlar vest holes underneath the arm, are we? Mm-hmm. We're the ones who are going to be taking care of different lines of the movement. I mean, like, think about this in a war, like the War Department of the United States, how they had to organize everything into companies, brigades, divisions, battalions, etc. Everything's all separated up, and it wasn't everybody doing the exact same thing all as one mass. It was actually so many different people going into different areas of expertise for a combined war effort that actually made it happen, and also getting massive financing by the bankers. So we don't have the opportunity to have massive financing, and we never will. There's not any good people out there who are rich enough to finance a covert conspiratorial war against the current conspirators who are basically committing genocide and slavery on a mass scale, and have been doing so for quite some time. So the situation to me appears hopeless, right? And the reason why I feel that it's hopeless is because I've seen so many people rise up and get put down. Like you say, these leaders come up and then they just get demonized, sabotaged, attacked, and destroyed, and they're gone. Gone. Mm-hmm. So the way that you can get your way around being co-opted as a movement is not actually having a movement, having no head of the snake to cut off. That's why I talk about how the individual has effect. So me, by myself, one guy in New Zealand has made 2,955 videos and has more subscribers than the largest newspaper in the country that's been around since like 1908. Okay? Right. One guy did that. You can look at any example of any single person that has made big, big changes. And it's usually a group effort, true, but there's always one person at the head of it, and depending on the organization, they can or can't be infiltrated. Me, I'm a one-man organization, and the only way I get my money is, other than, you know, just starting with the ad revenue, which is basically just passive income anyway, is by donations. So if people go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and they donate $5 or $10 a month or just make a one-off, these little contributions that keep coming into my bank accounts every day have paid every single one of my bills, not one included, since 2012. Okay, so by sheerly going out there for free and serving the people that are doing the right thing and merely playing my part, I have managed to generate enough community support, or community karma, as I like to call it, to morally obligate people to support me. And this is the biggest piece of advice that I have for people. And if you want to go out there and make a difference, sometimes your first big mistake is asking for help, thinking that you need it, thinking that you can't just take responsibility and start learning and start doing. I went to a party one time and these guys were there, and I asked them what they did for a living. They said, oh, we work in the movie industry. We do green screening. And I go, oh, really? I want to get into the movie industry. How do you do that? And they say, well, just do it. And yeah. It was ultimately the best piece of advice I ever had, because I just did. I was able to go out, get myself a camera and a Mac computer, because I was the good salesman. But ultimately, I felt that selling people things that didn't matter and didn't help change the world in some way, or being a part of any kind of hierarchical structure, became something that gave me panic attacks. All right, last two job interviews I've been to, I just couldn't do it, man.
Really?
Yeah, been too screwed over by too many employers over too long a period of time. It's kind of like if you try to teach somebody to swim several times, and each time you try to teach them to swim, they nearly drown. And then by the sixth time or seventh time, they stop wanting to go in the water, and they never go in the water again. It's kind of like that.
Have you ever considered a subscriber-based show?
I have. And technically it is. But the thing is, if you're a subscriber, you don't get anything extra. You get the same as everybody else. You know, that's what I talk about when I talk about eliminating conflicts of interest, because this way nobody can control me. You don't donate to me because you're about to get something for it. You donate to me because I've already given you something,
mm-hmm.
and you want to give something back.
Yeah, that's great. Speaking of all this, you have a fundraising campaign going on right now. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, indeed. I am creating a documentary. In fact, I might be able to pull up the wee thingamajigger here and read it out, because I was really considering how the world doesn't know about the interlinking conspiracies and scumbaggery, you know, that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. I'm going to make a documentary and bring all the big names and things that I've interviewed over the years all together, and get bullet points out of them. And then I'm going to turn those bullet points into a script, and then I'm going to get them to read the script out, just their particular bullet points and what have you, and then I'm going to cut it all together, and it's going to be a top to bottom, including damn near everything. Now, I need 8,000 New Zealand dollars, that's 6,000 US, and this is for the purchasing of a camera and a powerful Mac Pro, which will simply have enough juice to edit a documentary on my computer, because at the moment my one's getting a wee bit old, and it's even proving to be difficult to do even short videos now. So any assistance that people want to do, you can go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate on the homepage there. So I'll just give you a breakdown of some of the topics we're going to be covering in the doco, and I want to release this on the 4th of July in line for Independence Day, because it's actually...
Very auspicious, yeah.
Well, the thing is, the documentary is about New Zealand, but it's actually pitched at an American audience, okay? So, mm-hmm. for example, our Prime Minister, John Key, was a corporate banker, and he worked for the Federal Reserve, and he got elected in 2008 to save us from the financial crisis for campaigning for a blue party on a campaign platform of change. Does that sound familiar? and in his first term, he got New Zealand into more debt than all previous prime ministers in the history combined. Does that sound familiar?
I'm sensing a pattern here.
All right, so that's how the style of the documentary is actually going to move through. It's going to show these exact parallels between New Zealand and America, and you'll be able to think of that as a template. This is the reason why you'll be able to see the conspiracy really coming into view and how it actually works, is you put a different label and a different accent, and people think that it's different, and we're going to just show you that it's not. So, firstly, we're going to cover international banking and derivatives markets, blind trusts, and loans created out of nothing and charging interest. And we're going to look at, these are in no particular order, secret societies, John Key's ties to Freemasonry and the 33rd degree mantra, order out of chaos, origins of the powerful roundtable groups and think tanks like Parliamentarians for Global Action, the UN, the Committee for Auckland, Project for a New American Century, Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission, Agenda 21 and climate change and the elite agenda to control all human activity, our toxic environment, chemical contamination of food, air and water, smart meters, Wi-Fi, dirty electricity and the threat to health and mental ability, corruption, state capture, and how it's possible to influence government at the policy level, the intelligentsia, how it finances black ops with drugs and is in the process of setting up an irresistible global surveillance grid to control and monitor both citizens and elected officials alike, false flag terrorism and the Hegelian dialectic, or problem-reaction-solution, how staging crises can be used as a tool for rapid social engineering through fear, psychopaths, the mentality, behavior, and red flags showing if your leader is one of them. The left-right paradigm, how both major parties and now even minor parties support almost exactly the same policies as each other. Trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, NAFTA, and the European Economic Community, how they undermine national sovereignty and prepare nations for governance by international corporations and globalist authorities. NATO, the coming world army, New Zealand and other nations' role in a militarized future, depopulation, covert sterilizing agents currently in the world food chain, evidence of plans for large-scale extermination of the human race, engineered bioweapon outbreaks, covert technology, and touching on the medical industry, which is arguably the Western world's leading cause of death. Only a few more entries to go and we're done. Media, how it was infiltrated, corrupted, and is now used predominantly as a tool for shaping and limiting public perception. Geopolitics and the slow, steady, stealthy setup of an irresistible fascist world government that may dominate humanity forever. And the closing chapter of the film will focus on simple, common-sense solutions that anyone can implement in their own lives. Inspiring stories, discoveries, and case studies illustrating successful resistance to tyranny throughout history. Why there is cause for hope and a moral obligation to play a part in ensuring the survival of the free human race. Because there's not much point in survival if we're not free.
Well said. Yeah, that was really heavy and really potent. Then all of a sudden there was the breather at the end. So that's good. So
yeah, well,
that sounds awesome, man. So it really does. Yeah.
Well, the whole topic matter is going to be done in my genuine style of wordplay and fun and sarcasm and all of that kind of stuff. So it's going to be like, oh, we're so fucked, bro. Oh, that's hilarious.
Well, sweet, man. Well, good luck with all of that, man. I hope you reach your goal and everything like that. So please, everybody out there, go to VinnieEastwood.com, right? And that's where they can go to support you?
It's the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Or just search Vinnie Eastwood, Vinnie with a Y. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Cool. Well, yeah, we're about out of time here. So thanks for coming on, man. You're doing really great stuff. I really appreciate what you do, and I wish you well in the future, man.
Ditto.
All right. I guess we'll see you on the conspiracy front sometime, right?
Yeah. Or the conspiracy back end or something, you know. Other people can go and fight at the front and, like, talk to people in person and stuff like that and get shoved around on main roads while they're protesting 9/11 being an inside job like I have been, you know. I'll leave that to the younger men, you know.
All right. Cool. Vinny, great talking to you. Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
All right.